From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Gunther Schuller is one of the most respected writers on jazz. When he was writing his History of the Swing Era, he listened back to over 30,000 records. Coming up, we listen with Gunther Schuller to some of the records he reevaluated. Also today, Peter Conrad talks about his return visit to his native Tasmania, an island off the continent of Australia that was first used as a penal colony. Conrad says Tasmanians are guilty and secretive about their past. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of Avro Pärt's Passio. An Egyptian emigre, Gregory Janikian, reads a poem about his first attempts to assimilate into the American mainstream. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The word swing entered the popular vocabulary in the 1930s, the decade that swing music became the nation's popular music. Gunther Schuller has just completed his book, The Swing Era, which covers developments in jazz from 1930 to 1945. He writes about such band leaders as Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Benny Goodman, Earl Hines, Jimmy Lunsford, and Louis Armstrong, and such soloists as Art Tatum, Coleman Hawkins, Jack Teagarden, and Lester Young. The Swing Era is the second volume in Schuller's History of Jazz series. Gunther Schuller is a composer, arranger, and educator. He was president of the New England Conservatory of Music from 1967 to 77 and has guest conducted orchestras in the U.S. and Europe. We asked him to choose just a few of his favorite records from the swing era to play and discuss for us. Much has already been written on that period in jazz. I asked Schuller if his goal was to re-listen to and re-evaluate the records of the era.
Absolutely, Terry. In fact, although I knew when I started on this book a lot about jazz and about the swing era, I set it as my basic premise that I didn't know a darn thing and that I was going to start tabula rasa, listening from the very beginnings. Rather than take the approach, here's what I like and here's what I know and this is what I'm going to write about, rather, as I say, I know nothing and I'm going to start listening. And that was a very instructive, interesting, fascinating way to listen because by also adding to that premise the fact that I would listen systematically and chronologically through each artist's work or each orchestra's work, you know, so that I could trace and not only trace but actually feel their development as it grew. In that sense, I was able to discover not only all kinds of things would have been previously neglected in one way or another, either persons or players or pieces or compositions, but also gained a kind of long-range perspective on the development of these bands and orchestras and musicians, and also cross-referencing, cross-listening, you know, across a given period of time, like a year like 1935, very crucial year, what all was going on and comparing all that. So this kind of comprehensive, systematic listening allowed me to do that and gave me many fresh insights, which I don't think I would have had I come with my preconceptions and my prior knowledge.
Well, given all the listening you've been doing, I thought it would be both fun and instructive to listen to some records with you. So we've asked you to choose some records to play on the show today, and we'll talk about them. Why don't we get started with some of the music we're going to open with Duke Ellington's 1940 recording of Cottontail. You spend a lot of time talking about this in your book.
Well, I spend a lot of time on Duke Ellington. He has the biggest chapter. It's over 130 or 40 pages. And that is, of course, because he is certainly the greatest jazz composer. Then he also was a remarkable pianist and arranger, of course, along with that. And then a band leader who led a band, a great orchestra, for over 40 years. All of that makes him one of the most important people in the whole history of jazz.
The piece we're going to hear, Cottontail, you describe as a precursor of modern jazz.
Yes, it was certainly a piece in advance of its own time, and it was a piece that the young arrangers, the young musicians coming up in the late 30s and early 40s were certainly listening to very avidly. It's a sort of proto-bebop piece already.
And you also describe Ben Webster's terrific solo on it.
Yes, this is one of the great solos in all history of jazz.
So we'll listen for that, Ben Webster on tenor saxophone. This is Duke Ellington playing Cottontail. ¶¶ Duke Ellington and his orchestra, a 1940 recording of Cottontail. And that's one of the many records discussed in the new book, The Swing Era, written by my guest, Gunther Schuller, who is an educator, historian, composer, and conductor, former president of the New England Conservatory of Music. Gunther Schuller, anything else you want to say about the record that we just heard before we move on to the next one?
Well, what makes it so modern for its time is the sleek lines, particularly the opening theme. That kind of streamlining and that linearization of the music is very much a key to the incoming music then called bebop. The other thing that's interesting about the piece, it's a wholly original composition, and yet it is based on one of the most common standard tunes which everyone was playing by that time, namely George Gershwin's I Got Rhythm. The chord changes on which that piece is based are Gershwin's I Got Rhythm.
Now let's make a comparison here. Ellington certainly had one of the best-known and most popular bands of the swing era, and Basie led another of the most popular bands of the time, yet the kind of music that they played was really different. Let's see what kind of comparison we can make between the two. You've also brought a Basie recording with you.
Yes, Texas Shuffle, which is a composition by Herschel Evans. And this is indeed quite different, particularly in the form of the piece. This is what we sometimes call in music a bolero form, that is to say a piece which builds very gradually in layers upwards towards a climax. And indeed, this is composed in layers, and what's interesting about it is the thing that Basie and the whole Kansas City style developed was what we call the riff, you know, which is a kind of simple line which gets played during a chorus or during a given passage. And the notes are always the same, but the harmonies underneath the riff are changing. And you can, of course, have many layers of riff. You know, you can have one riff in the trombones, another an octave higher in the saxophones, and then on top of that you can have rhythmic riffs, and then on top of all that you can have soloists playing a solo against this entirely complex background. So that's really the basis of the construction of this piece.
Okay, let's give it a listen.
Thank you.
That was Count Basie and his band playing Texas Shuffle. Gunther Schuller, of all the Count Basie records, why did you want to single out this particular one for us to hear?
Well, because it is one of the most well constructed, and although I said that the band in its early days was mostly a kind of loose congregation of soloing players, this has a compositional foundation to it, which I very much appreciate in the Basie canon. And yet, even with that having been said, one notices immediately how differently that music swings. You know, the momentum of that and the feeling of that is so different from Ellington. So proving that there are many kinds of swinging, and they're all good.
Well, I want to talk with you more about the swing era, the subject of your new book, after we take a short break. And my guest is composer, conductor, educator, and historian Gunther Schuller. And by the way, a little later in the program, we'll hear some of his own music. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Gunther Schuller is my guest. And from 1967 to 77, he was the president of the New England Conservatory of Music. He's just written a new book called The Swing Era, that's a history of jazz from 1930 to 1945. And we asked him to bring some of the records of the swing era with him today to play for us. I should say that this new book, The Swing Era, has just been published by Oxford University Press. Well, we've just heard two bands that are among the most popular bands of the period, the Basie Band and the Ellington Band. And I want to ask you to play something now from McKinney's Cotton Pickers, which is a band that you mentioned in your book has been overlooked in many jazz histories, including your own previous book.
Well, and not so much the band, but the particular composer-arranger who was responsible for some of the best music that the McKinney Cotton Pickers played. I think this is one of the most important achievements of my book, if I may say so, because what I did here was to resuscitate from total oblivion the man John Nesbitt, who was the trumpet player and arranger and composer responsible for the piece that we're going to play, and many others. And what happened here was that evidently in the past, through what confusion I can't figure out, the best pieces of the McKinney Cotton Pickers have previously been ascribed to Don Redman, who was certainly a very important early arranger. In fact, one could argue that he was the man who set the basic arranging style for larger orchestras in jazz in the mid-20s. But in the case of his relationship to the McKinney Cotton Pickers, he was not responsible for the best pieces. Those were the work of this John Nesbitt. And John Nesbitt is a man who is never mentioned in any jazz histories or encyclopedias. So I'm very proud of the rediscovery, so to speak, of Nesbitt and these remarkable pieces, which, like the Ellington and Basie piece that we've heard, show yet another different way of integrating improvisation with composition, which is, after all, one of the main difficulties in the language of jazz. I mean, basically an improvised music, the heart and soul of jazz is certainly improvisation, spontaneous composing. But then, in the greatest works in jazz, you have this situation where you then have to integrate those improvisations by a variety of soloists into something called a composition or a basic format of some kind of frame of reference. And Nesbitt, who was very much influenced by Duke Ellington, did this most brilliantly in this piece called Crying and Sighing.
Well, let's hear it. And this, I believe, was recorded in 1928.
Yes, very early on.
Okay, let's give it a listen.
Thank you.
McKinney's Cotton Pickers, as recorded in 1928, Cryin and Cyan. Gunther Schiller, this is a band I've been partial to for for a long time. I think what I particularly react to is the vitality of the arrangements and the improvisations.
Exactly, exactly. Now, this is, of course, not swing or pure swing in the sense that we thought of it later, but it does have that tremendous energy and that forward momentum that is one of the qualities of swing. It's a little vertical yet, and that was the difference, you know, when the music moved into the swing, it changed from a kind of vertically realized music into something much more horizontal and forward-flowing.
You know, you were talking right before we heard this record about the balance between composition and improvisation in jazz. And I think you make a very interesting point in your book about the sometimes overemphasis on improvisation. You say that having listened to so many records, it's become really clear to you that improvisations aren't totally spontaneous because in all the alternate takes, what's played in the improvisations is pretty similar.
Yes. It was a great discovery even for me, I mean, as much as I've listened to jazz all of my life, because what happened during the period of my writing swing era, which took almost 20 years, there were tremendous reissue programs by the record companies, and in many cases they issued alternate takes. Previously we had known the first chosen take, you know, whatever it was that they picked out, but now we were hearing second and third and fourth versions, in many cases not as good as the one that was originally issued. And then we noticed that the solos, the so-called solos, which we all thought were off-the-cuff improvisations, tended to be either memorized solos or in some way prepared solos, and in essence the same in many of these takes. It's not always true, but that was more the case than not. And that, of course, puts an entirely different light on this question of true improvisation. Now, that has changed, by the way. We should say that in the modern era, the musicians of today and of the last 20, 30 years do, in fact, improvise freshly, totally spontaneously. But in the swing era, this was not so common. The techniques, the whole conception of improvisation had not developed to the point where they could do that, except maybe in the case of some of the very greatest musicians.
Well, you think that there's even a patronizing or racist element that sometimes enters into an overemphasis on improvisation?
Yes, you know, sort of the happy native who's not trained to read music doing these great things by sheer guts and improvisation. Well, it just turns out not to be the case that many of these musicians did, in fact, think about these solos before they so-called improvised them. And we can document this also in the case of many musicians who played the same solo over and over again over a period of a decade. So those kinds of solos became an essential part of the composition, you see.
Well, the next thing I want to do is to apologize to our listeners that we're not going to get to hear all the records that we'd like to have played for you. But time goes very quickly, and we did want to play you whole records and not just excerpts. But I want to make this disclaimer as well and say that the records that we've heard were not meant to be the definitive recordings of the swing era, but rather some terrific recordings.
Thank you.
That we wanted to play and that I wanted to hear Gunther Schiller talk about. Now, you had said before that one of the things you did was re-listen to everything.
Yes.
Give me an example of a record that you heard that you totally changed your mind on, something that you dismissed earlier and that you really came to appreciate now.
Well, I guess, for example, the band that later became the Cab Calloway Band, I had dismissed them pretty casually in my earlier book, Early Jazz. It was a band called the Missourians. And now, when I had to listen to all of the Cab Calloway recordings, who was a most important figure in the swing era, I wanted to also find out how the Cab Calloway Band got the way it was, and where did it come from? And it had several predecessors. One of them was this band called the Missourians. So I kind of rediscovered what a terrific orchestra they were, like the one that you just mentioned about McKinney Cotton Pickers, a band that played with tremendous energy, a certain kind of roughness, but very exciting, and not smooth like, you know, some of the jazz bands in New York were trying to play at that time. So anyway, that was just one of the rediscoveries. But for example, talking about Cab Calloway, I discovered what a great singer Cab Calloway was. I mean, not just the hidey-ho man who did all this hollering and screaming and dancing, which he did marvelously and a great entertainer, but that he was a great singer who, had conditions been otherwise, he could have been one of the greatest baritones and basses at the Metropolitan Opera, you know. I mean, this is a real, real voice, you know. And I took great pleasure in discovering some of those performances and of his, you know, singing, what we might call just straight singing, ballad singing.
Well, I want to save a little bit of time for a new record of yours. And Gunther Schuller has a new compact disc out called Jumpin' in the Future. And this is basically recordings of arrangements that he made mostly from the 1950s. And there's a story behind this record.
Well,
would you tell it?
Also compositions. I mean, some arrangements, some are compositions.
Right.
Well, basically, these were a variety of things that I did at one time or another. The earliest one goes back to 1947, and I think the latest one is in the late 50s or something. And what happened was that my son, both of my sons are jazz musicians, one of them, George, the drummer, rummaging around in my music in my house, you know, he found these things. Hey, Dad, what are these? What are these things? When did you do these? And he kind of got me interested in them again. And to make a long story short, he then conspired to get an NEA recording grant for the band in which he plays, which is called Orange Then Blue. It's a kind of a small big band in Boston. And we all ended up recording these early pieces and arrangements of mine with that band on my label.
Well, I want to play your arrangement of Yesterday's. But before we hear that, I want to thank you very much for coming and doing Fresh Air with us. Thank you.
Always a pleasure, Tony.
And thanks for bringing your records with you, too. They were really fun to listen to. Thank
okay,
you.
Good.
And my guest has been Gunther Schuller, who is a composer, arranger, educator, and historian. And his new book is called The Swing Era, The Development of Jazz, 1930 to 1945. It's just been published by the Oxford University Press. And his new record, Jumpin' in the Future, is on his GM record label. And from that record, this is Gunther Schuller's recording, arrangement of Yesterday's. Next time on Fresh Air, investigating the oceans with Robert Ballard, the man who discovered the remains of the Titanic and is pioneering new techniques in ocean exploration. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The popular American image of Australia has been shaped by Crocodile Dundee and beer commercials. Peter Conrad has written a book about returning to his native Tasmania. Coming up, he paints a different picture about Australian life. Even before poet Gregory Janikian arrived in America, he knew of it through popular songs and images. Today he reads a poem that recalls his first attempts at assimilation. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of Passio, composer Arvo Pärt's 1982 version of the St. John Passion. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. A federal indictment charging the leaders of the Colombian Medellin drug cartel and others with drug trafficking was unsealed today in Jacksonville, Florida. Lee Taylor has details.
The 70-page indictment charges them with conspiracy and operating a continuing criminal enterprise. There are also allegations that the cartel set up the assassination of the Colombian Minister of Justice back in 1984 and bribed Nicaraguan officials to use an Air Force base for drug trafficking. So far, six people named in the indictment have been arrested in a nationwide sweep. Two of those named, Carlos Lader and Jack Carlton Reed, are already serving prison terms after conviction on other charges. The indictment also touches on the Prime Minister of the Bahamas, Lyndon Penling. One of those charged is Everett Bannister, said to be a close friend of the Prime Minister. But U.S. Attorney Robert Ginsman refuses to comment on an allegation that Penling had been named in the first draft of the indictment and then removed. Ginsman says the U.S. will attempt to bring the foreign nationals named in the indictment to trial, but that won't be easy. It took federal authorities 6 years to arrest Carlos Lader and bring him to Jacksonville for trial. Lee Taylor for National Public Radio in Jacksonville, Florida.
President Bush today traveled outside Washington to promote his anti-drug package. After warning high school students in Pennsylvania of the dangers of drugs, the president flew to Delaware and spoke to more than 2,000 law enforcement officers. Doug Schlatter of member station WHYY has details.
President Bush told the group that he is on their side in the drug battle, both with more federal dollars for law enforcement and limiting drug-related violence. The president said that a solution must be quickly found on limiting the sale of assault rifles, which are now being used by many drug dealers. Bush said that a balance must be reached between the rights of sportsmen and the rights of police officers, who he said put their lives on the line. The president targeted the NRA by name, saying the group will have to realize that these types of weapons have to be restricted.
But I happen to believe that the vast majority of NRA members support the position I've just taken, that the time has come to do something about these automated weapons that are threatening the lives of these people behind me. And I'm going to see that it takes place.
The administration has already temporarily suspended the importation of assault rifles into the country. For National Public Radio, this is Doug Schlatter in Philadelphia.
The U.S. today urged the Palestine Liberation Organization to take practical steps to ease tensions in the Israeli-occupied territories. In Tunisia today, the U.S. and PLO held 4 hours of talks, the first since President Bush took office. But afterwards, PLO officials blamed Israel for tensions in the territories and said it is the United States' responsibility to stop, quote, Israeli terrorism against Palestinians. A second round of talks is expected within the next few weeks. Democrats have lowered their target for an increase in the minimum wage to $4.55 an hour in legislation debated in the House today. The bill also contains an administration-backed proposal for a sub-minimum training wage, but the Democratic measure allows the lower pay to continue for only 60 days, not 6 months, as President Bush has proposed. Bush has said he will veto any bill calling for a minimum wage above 4.25. A House vote is expected tomorrow. The Supreme Court ruled today that the FBI may withhold so-called rap sheets from groups or individuals requesting them under the Freedom of Information Act. In a broadly worded opinion, the court said a federal law aimed at curtailing government secrecy does not require the FBI or any other agency to release information about private citizens. The 9-0 decision killed a lawsuit that was filed by a reporter and the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. Stock prices were lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 3 points to close at 2,263. Declines led advances 4-3 on volume of 147 million shares. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange lost 8 cents. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The story of the Passion, according to St. John, has been set to music by many composers, and it's often sung during the Easter season. There's a new recording of a modern St. John Passion by the Estonian-born composer Arvo Pärt. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review.
Thank you. That was the magnificent opening statement of Arvo Pärt's Passio, his setting of the passage in the Gospel of St. John about the trial and crucifixion of Christ. Pärt is an anomaly these days, a truly religious composer. His devotion is evident in every note. Whatever your religious persuasion, it would be hard not to be moved by the simple yet ineluctable unfolding of this most profound event in the spiritual history of mankind. The best-known version of the St. John Passion is, of course, by Bach. It's one of Bach's greatest musical achievements, maybe the most dramatic vocal music he wrote. For modern secular audiences, though, it can also be a disturbing work. Its drama lies not so much in the suffering of Christ or in the believer's response to the events of Holy Week, as it does in Bach's even greater passion, the St. Matthew. What's dramatic in the St. John are the scenes of mob violence, the angry demands of the Hebrews for the crucifixion of Jesus. Bach's powerful setting has offended some Jewish members of the audience. Some Jewish musicians have waged heavy battles of conscience before deciding whether to participate. But Pärt's Passio is the opposite of dramatic. Its aim is not to arouse tension or conflict at all, but to present and contemplate a mystery, a sublime ritual. It begins with the assumption that each gesture is symbolic. Pärt emphasizes the passages in which St. John writes that these events were all predestined in order that the prophecy might be fulfilled, that no one was to blame. And yet, it's Pärt's very sincerity that makes the question of anti-Semitism even trickier to deal with in a St. John Passion composed in 1982 than in one composed in 1723. Finally, I think it's the beauty and humanity of Pärt's music, or Bach's, or anyone's, that transcends these nagging questions. Pärt achieves his spiritual exaltation through an extraordinary use of traditional musical techniques, pacing, voicing, and harmony. Passio proceeds as slowly and continuously as a heartbeat. Time is so suspended that even though it lasts 70 minutes, you don't feel or notice its length. The voicings are very simple, but surprising. Jesus is sung by a bass, Pilate by a tenor. These are the only characters with solos. The evangelist, who narrates the story, is sung by a vocal quartet, soprano, countertenor, tenor, and baritone. A chamber choir sings the voices of everyone else. Only five instruments supply the accompaniment: violin, oboe, cello, bassoon, and organ. and they surround the voices with a glowing halo of sound. Widely spaced harmonies add to the sense of timelessness. There's practically only one melody, yet its simplicity, like Gregorian chant, never grows tiresome. The performance by the Hilliard Ensemble under Paul Hillier couldn't be more accomplished or heartfelt.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the new ECM recording of Arvo Pärt's Passio. This is Fresh Air. What was it like to grow up in a land considered the place of no return? Peter Conrad, a writer and teacher of literature at Oxford, grew up in Tasmania, an Australian island south of the mainland. England used Australia as a penal colony for its most hardened criminals. The outcasts of Australia were exiled to Tasmania, which Conrad describes as the place of ultimate banishment and estrangement. Growing up, Peter Conrad dreamed of getting off the island. He did, but he went back years later to face the past he tried so hard to leave behind. His memoir, Behind the Mountain, is the story of his return.
About halfway through my life, at least I hope my sums are right, I began to wonder about what I had lost. At the time, I hadn't so much lost it as thrown it away, with a negligence I considered cool. When I left home at the age of 20, it was without a backward glance. First went two tea chests, shipping my books to England. What remained I carried in endless relays out to the rusted incinerator in our yard between the fragrant compost heap and the stilted avenues of beans. There, scrutinized by neighbors pausing at their kitchen windows as they did the washing up, I set fire to all the leavings of my life so far. Diaries and exercise books, bundles of letters tied by string, anything that might incriminate me by attaching an identity to me. The cruel cleanness of it now amazes me. But at that age, it's easy to cremate a portion of your life. You don't believe in memory and so can have no affections. Thus, I loaded the funeral pyre with the attributes of a self I was to regard from now on, I thought, as irrelevant, the discarded first draft of a person.
When you were burning that first part of your life in the big funeral pyre, what were you about to do in your life?
About to travel with the books, which I salvaged, to Oxford to take up a Rhodes Scholarship. And I looked upon that as really the beginning of my life. This was just kind of prelude. And since all of my imaginary life so far, all of my imagined life had been lived in England and lived inside the English books that I'd been reading, I regarded this as just a sort of strange exile which I had finally been rescued from.
But you didn't really grow up in England. You grew up in Tasmania, which you'd describe as, you say Australia had been a place for banishment, and Tasmania had been a place of internal exile.
Mm-hmm. It was the place to which the convicts who had been sent to the Australian mainland were banished if they proved such hardened offenders that they offended again once they arrived in the penal colony. And it was a place which was regarded, for geographical reasons, as a natural penitentiary. It was a place cast away at the very bottom of the earth from which there was simply no escape. And this fairly black, bleak past is something that impends on everyone who grows up there in some way, I think. I mean, we've just wandered around on the little island looking out across these oceans, hoping that someday someone might come and take us away. And in my case, it was Cecil Rhodes who intervened with a scholarship and took me away.
How did your parents end up in Tasmania? How did your family get there?
I'm not quite sure, and I don't think they're sure either. They indignantly deny, both of them, that they were sent there in shackles and chains, although now it's quite chic to have a convict ancestor in the family in these days of bicentennial patriotism. But I think they migrated there, both families, from impoverished backgrounds, one in England, the other in Germany at the end of the 19th century. But such is the sort of sadness and moodiness of the place, and also such is the kind of contagious guilt that people feel in the place about the past, that all traces, all of family history have sort of been wiped out. It's not something that anyone chooses to talk about for fear that something unpleasant or something unhappy will be uncovered. I mean, there's no great optimistic saga of emigration to Tasmania as there is to the United States. It's a place where people are sent under duress, where they go in misery, and which they don't care to remember the reasons for their arriving in.
So the guilt comes from the fact that a lot of the settlers in Tasmania were convicts, and also that the settlers there wiped out most of the Aboriginals who lived there.
Yes, yes. The first sort of pastoral settlers, the first English people who went out to set up little rural estates, found to their chagrin that there were no foxes to hunt as they had done in the mother country. So they hunted Aboriginals instead, and within 30 or 40 years, this race, which was a quite unique and peculiar race, separated from the Stone Age Australian Aborigines, rather more Polynesian and also rather more developed and civilized, within 30 or 40 years it had simply been wiped out. So that there's a lot of grim history to be forgotten in that little place.
It must be interesting to grow up in a place that most people know nothing about. I mean, when you left Tasmania and you went to England to go to school and then you lived in New York for a while before moving back to England, how much did your friends know about where you were from?
Absolutely nothing. In England, they mostly assumed that Tasmania had something to do with New Zealand, since they knew it was an island, and they assumed that it was probably the third island of New Zealand. In this country, I've often been mistaken for a native of Tanzania. It's a funny place to grow up in, because you have to constantly explain to people where it is. It's also proved to be a convenient place to pretend that people grew up in. I mean, I was immensely heartened when I was growing up there myself to learn from some movie magazine that I read that Merle Oberon had been born in Tasmania. It was not that I had any adolescent crush on Merle Oberon, but I found this news infinitely exciting, because I thought, well, if Merle Oberon was born here, then it proves that one can be born here but still get out and become someone. Fortunately, it wasn't until much later on that I learned that Merle Oberon had never been anywhere near Tasmania, and she was just assigned Tasmania as a birthplace, quite arbitrarily, by the Hollywood publicists in the 30s who wanted to conceal the fact that she was actually Eurasian. So it's like kind of birth in limbo, in a way. I mean, it's not a place which is taken very seriously, even by the Australians on the mainland in the 19th century, when Tasmania was called Van Diemen's Land, after the Dutch navigator who first discovered it. Its natives, when they went to the mainland carrying this kind of bloody penal past with them, were referred to either as the Van Demonians, or else, even more succinctly, as the Demons. So it's a place which people are accustomed to apologizing for coming from.
What do you think of the Crocodile Dundee movies and the Paul Hogan Come to Australia advertisements that we see so much on television now? You're from Tasmania and not the mainland of Australia, but they're right near each other and they have very similar histories.
Oh, yes, and the whole Crocodile Dundee persona has very much been taken up by Tasmanian bushmen. I describe in the book being taken around one of the logging camps by a tour guide who'd been assigned to me, whose whole persona was modelled on Crocodile Dundee. I think it's kind of deplorable, because just at the moment when Australia seemed about to escape from a mythology imposed on it by one empire, by the British Empire, it now seems to have accepted a very American notion of itself as, you know, a kind of extradited bit of the American frontier. And Crocodile Dundee is nothing more than an American backwoodsman, a kind of Natty Bumppo character from American mythology, who's been transposed down there and who enables Americans to feel that Australia is a good place because it's a bit of unspoiled America. Somehow or other, Australia, which entered the world so late and was so cast away from the rest of the world, is still having tremendous problems arriving at an image of itself, and only sees itself still as the distorted reflection of places elsewhere.
Your book, Behind the Mountain, is a result of your trip back to Tasmania. Why did you go back?
because I'd begun to brood about it more and more, I guess it was a terrible incipient sign of middle age that I left at the age of 20 for about the next 15 years. I was so excited by the new life that I was having in England or in the United States that I didn't look over my shoulder at all and thought I'd completely outgrown it. I guess it has something to do with the getting of wisdom or the arrival of middle age that in the middle of my 30s I began to brood more and more about this, to dream more and more about it, to become more and more intrigued by it and more aware that it was the most formative place for me. It was the place that had made me, the place which was still dictating the scenario of my dreams, and a place which I couldn't afford any longer to pretend that I hadn't come from.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Peter Conrad's memoir, Behind the Mountain, is published by Poseidon Press. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is joining us from Washington, D.C. to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. What story is he following?
Well, we're following the meetings today between the PLO and the U.S. Ambassador to Tunisia. It's first of the Bush administration. It's supposed to be a substantive meeting. We'll also be hearing about Pete Rose and the Commissioner of Baseball and what's happening with the probe into allegations of Rose's that possibly Rose was gambling. Also, a talk with Marion Burroughs, who writes great cookbooks. The latest one is called The 20-Minute Menu Cookbook, and it's not so much a cookbook as a way of life. And also with Ed Herlihy, who was the voice on the newsreels for 25 years.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Poet Gregory Janikian was born in Alexandria, Egypt, and came to this country with his family in 1957, when he was seven. They first lived in Tarrytown, New York, and then moved to Pennsylvania. We invited Janikian to read a poem from his new book, Falling Deeply into America.
In the elementary school choir. I had never seen a cornfield in my life. I had never been to Oklahoma, but I was singing as loud as anyone. Oh, what a beautiful morning. The corn is as high as an elephant's eye. Though I knew something about elephants, I thought, coming from the same continent as they did, and they being more like camels than anything else. And when we sang from Meet Me in St. Louis, clang, clang, clang went the trolley, I remembered the ride from Ramleh Station in the heart of Alexandria all the way to Rushdie, where my grandmother lived, the autos on the roadway vying with mule carts and bicycles, the Mediterranean half a mile off on the left, the air smelling sharply of diesel and salt. It was a problem which had dogged me for a few years, this confusion of places, and when in fifth grade geography I had pronounced Des Moines as though it were a village in France, Mr. Kephart led me to the map on the front wall, and so I'd know where I was, pressed my forehead squarely against Iowa. Des Moines, he'd said, rhymes with coins. Now we were singing zippity-doo-dah, zippity-yay, and every song we'd sung had in it either sun or bluebirds, fair weather or fancy fringe, oh, beautiful America. And one tier below me, there was Linda Deemer with her amber waves and lovely fruited plains, and she was part of America, too, along with sun and spacious sky, though untouchable, and as distant as purple mountains of majesty. This is my country, we sang. And a few years ago, there would have been a scent of figs in the air, mangoes, and someone playing the oud along a clear stream. But now it was my country, 'tis of thee, and I sang it out with all my heart, and now with Linda Deemer in mind. Land where my fathers died, I bellowed, and it was not too hard to imagine a host of my great uncles and grandfathers stunned from their graves in the Turkish interior, and finding themselves suddenly on a rock among maize and poultry and squanto shaking their hands. How could anyone not think America was exotic when it had Massachusetts and the long tables of Thanksgiving? and how could it not be home if it were the place where love first struck? We had finished singing. The sun was shining through large windows on the beatified faces of all who had sung well and with feeling. We were ready to file out and march back to our room where Mr. Kephart was waiting. Already Linda Deemer had disappeared into the high society of the hallway. One day I was going to tell her something. Des Moines, I was saying to myself. Baton Rouge. Terre Haute. Boise.
Gregory Janikian teaches at the University of Pennsylvania. His new book, Falling Deeply into America, is published by Carnegie Mellon University Press. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, alien abduction, trans-channeling, and spontaneous human combustion. Ted Schultz has collected Believe It or Not literature since he was a child. He's the editor of a new Whole Earth catalog called The Fringes of Reason. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Nick of Time, the new album by Bonnie Raitt. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Fletch Lives. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistants from Christopher Cook and Peter Murdoch. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.